I next met with Dr. Joseph Connors to chat about lymphomas and CLL, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice with follicular lymphoma.
This is a patient that's kind of exemplary of patients with follicular lymphoma, and she went to her family physician basically because she was feeling tired and didn't have anything more specific than that. Her family physician, when he examined her, noted that she had some fairly easily palpable peripheral lymph nodes, and he then honed in on that as the thing that he wanted to best understand, and then maybe connect it back to the fatigue that she had come to him with. And so, convinced that there was something pathologic going on, he arranged for a surgical biopsy, and one of these easily resectable nodes was taken out, and the diagnosis was made. So he then asked us to see the patient in my lymphoma group, and we did, and arranged for reassessment of that diagnostic biopsy to make sure that it was correct, and then the staging testing to tell us where disease was located.
What was seen on the workup and what was seen on the pathology? What was the grade?
So this was a grade, it's now called grade 1-2 in the World Health Organization classification scheme. So that's a typical follicular lymphoma with the predominance of cells, the small cleaved nucleus type of small lymphocytes, small B lymphocytes. So the hematopathologist characterized this as a CD20 positive, very typical follicular lymphoma. That's a diagnosis where their diagnostic accuracy is above 95%. So when they call it, you know that's what the patient has.
And this lady's 72. What was her situation in terms of comorbidities and sort of general functional level?
She was in good shape. She had pretty high expectations of herself. So she was quite active in a number of social circles and physically active. I think she even played a bit of tennis. So she expected to have a fair bit of energy each day. And she thought that somewhat gradually over the last year or two, that had seemed to slip away, and she was feeling differently fatigued than she had in the past.
What was her diagnostic workup? What did that show?
Not unexpectedly, she wound up having generalized lymphadenopathy, so there was abnormal lymph nodes in the neck and axillary areas. As is typical of follicular lymphoma, there was sparing of the mediastinal structures, so there's not much going on in the thorax. But then in the retroperitoneum, there were visibly enlarged nodes throughout the retroperitoneum down into the retropelvis around the iliac vessels. So she's got stage 3 disease based on lymph node distribution. The other thing we did was a bone marrow biopsy, because about 50% of these patients will have involvement of their bone marrow, and that can be true even when their peripheral blood counts are perfectly normal. So you only know if you look. And so she had a bone marrow biopsy, and she did have involvement of the bone marrow. The cells matched up. They look fairly similar. They're distributed in a paratrabecular distribution, but they're small B cells. They label positive with CD20. They are apparently and provably clonal in origin if you do additional testing. So she winds up being the kind of patient that is upstaged to stage 4 because of that bone marrow biopsy.
What were the options that you went through with her, and what did you recommend?
Well, this is where the subtlety comes in, because the challenge here is seeing if there really is a connection between the fatigue that prompted her to go to the doctor and the disease. Because, as you can imagine, there are many causes of fatigue, varying from psychological and emotional through physical conditions of a variety of sorts. And it's a bit of a trap to just assume immediately that that fatigue is related to her lymphoma. Because obviously, if it isn't, and you treat the lymphoma, you may have no impact on the fatigue, and that's actually what was bothering her. So that's a situation in which I look for other clues. I go back to those blood tests, but in fact, her blood counts were normal. I'm sure I threw in some thyroid function testing. I looked kind of quickly, screened through the sorts of things that I would expect to be associated with fatigue. I was looking for normal renal and liver function, and they were present. So now I'm not turning up any other reason for her to be fatigued, and we went through what was going on in her life. She had no major losses recently. Nobody close to her had died. No big changes in her life that might have introduced substantially greater emotional stress. So I'm at a bit of a loss to explain it otherwise, but I'm still a little wary of promising a patient that I can make their fatigue go away, because many times I've treated these people and made their lymphoma clearly better, and the fatigue remains unchanged.
Would you have considered or recommended observation if she had the exact same disease situation but had no fatigue?
Well, that's exactly what my suspicion is here, and that is, had I found another explanation for the fatigue, or even with this caution that they may not be connected, I don't want to establish the expectation we're going to make it go away. So I'd now start to think of her as, how would I manage an asymptomatic patient in this situation? And for decades now, we've clinically found it acceptable to recommend watchful waiting in a patient like this, where we want to gain some sense, what's the pace of disease, how quickly is it changing, is in fact it causing this symptom it may or may not be causing. And I in fact was happiest in this patient's case to watch for a while with the explanation that if in fact this was a persistent problem, this fatigue, and she understood the limitations of what we could accomplish with treatment, that we might bring it in later, but that she was certainly suitable for watchful waiting.
How did that idea sit with her?
She was quite comfortable with it. She realized the uncertainty of the connection to what she had been noticing and didn't feel particularly threatened by her disease and happy enough to avoid the inconvenience and potential toxicity of treatment. So she went along with that plan. And in fact, after 3 to 6 months of watching, nothing had changed. Physical exam was the same. I didn't re-image her, but I could monitor the disease by palpating it. Laboratory studies stayed quite stable. And she said that this was continuing to really bother her. It was interfering with her doing the things that she wanted to do. So we then discussed options. And I think there are really two potential options on the table for interventions that are quite different. One of them is to use single-agent rituximab. So that's a monoclonal antibody directed against CD20, which these cells express. And when a patient is treatment naive, we know the response rate certainly is above 50%, probably in the order of 70 or 80% with single-agent rituximab. So it does make the disease better. But the other consideration here is that if she does take treatment, we'd not only like it to make the disease better, but we'd like that benefit to last as long as possible. And the depth of response, the quality of response that one would see, it would be expected to be better if she actually took multi-agent chemotherapy along with the rituximab. So we discussed these two possibilities, and she was sufficiently convinced that the fatigue was linked and that she wanted a real benefit, that she was willing to put up with the inconvenience and the toxicity of multi-agent chemotherapy, because she and I expected that if she had a good response to that, it could endure for quite some time. So that's what we embarked on for her. But I would have found it equally acceptable if she had said, no, she doesn't want all the toxicity connected with multi-agent chemotherapy. Couldn't I try something else? Then we would have tried single-agent rituximab.
So I see that at the time she was treated, BR hadn't been approved in Canada, so she got RCVP. Had a great response without much toxicity except neuropathy that caused you to drop the vincristine, and the fatigue actually improved with the treatment. What about our maintenance?
That was the next decision to make. We got through the 8 cycles of treatment. We had a good response. And we know from randomized prospective clinical trials that giving a course now of maintenance rituximab improves not only the progression-free survival, but at least some of the studies suggest it improves the overall survival. And so I said to her that you've paid your dues, you've taken on all of the toxicity of the multi-agent chemotherapy, and we have made things better, and we have this strategy of maintenance rituximab that will improve the likelihood this disease will stay inactive for a longer period of time and may, in fact, contribute to you actually living longer if we institute it now. So she's in the midst now of 2 years of planned maintenance rituximab. We use the once every 3 month schedule that was described by the EORTC, and she's tolerating that very well. No additional toxicity. It's just the fuss and bother of once every 3 months injection.
Any thoughts about BR in terms of the Rummel German trial and the North American Bright study? Now that you have it available, how are you using it?
Yeah, so bendamustine is one of those kind of surprising drugs that comes a little out of the left field because we'd heard of it many years ago, and it had a peculiar development path, originally being developed, tested, and used behind the Iron Curtain, and then gradually moving into the Western world. Adopted considerably earlier in the rest of Europe before North America, but now being widely used. And the striking thing is that with this single drug, it looks as though one can accomplish everything that was being accomplished by the multi-agent chemotherapy being linked to the rituximab. So the first study you were referring to was a comparison of CHOP, so that's cyclophosphamide, doxorubicin, vincristine, prednisone, and rituximab, CHOP-R, compared to bendamustine rituximab. And somewhat to people's surprise, the single agent bendamustine outperformed the four agents in CHOP. And the progression-free survival was substantially improved. And of course, the tolerance was better because you don't have the cardiotoxicity, you don't have the same level of myelosuppression, and the side effect profile is more attractive. So that's what's led to fairly wide adoption of the bendamustine rituximab for the indolent B-cell lymphomas. The BRIGHT study, I think, contributed some useful information about the genuine spectrum of toxicity. The description of the original Rummel study really concentrated more on efficacy, what it did against the disease, and I'm not sure we were able to discern the full spectrum of toxicity from that study. The BRIGHT study has reminded us that bendamustine is also a potent agent, that it does cause myelosuppression, somewhat more nausea than people had been thinking it was going to cause. And in our experience here in British Columbia, we've seen more rashes secondary to the bendamustine. So it's definitely a chemotherapy. It's definitely got those kinds of toxicities, but they're all quite manageable. And it is actually relatively attractive in the older patients because they do seem to be able to tolerate it fairly well in full doses.
We're also seeing a lot of usage. Initially, it was in older patients, I think, and I think it seems like now it's being used a lot more in younger patients. For example, if this same exact situation had occurred, but instead of being 72, she'd been, 52, would you still use BR?
Yeah, we were happy recently to change our treatment policies here in BC so that it has become our standard drug combination, bendamustine rituximab, for the full spectrum of indolent B-cell lymphomas.
And in terms of the issue of R maintenance, do you basically generally utilize that anytime you're using R chemo for 2 years, or are there situations where you don't?
It's become our standard for the patients with the indolent lymphomas. The studies that actually addressed its potential usefulness were focused on follicular lymphoma, but it doesn't seem too much of an extrapolation to include the other indolent B-cell lymphomas. So at least in some jurisdictions, that would be potentially thought of as off-label use, but it seems like a very reasonable extrapolation from everything else that we know about rituximab and CD20-positive lymphomas. So it's our standard now. And then there's a debate about which maintenance schedule to use, with no clear superiority to any one of them. So you'll see variations in the dosing between 375 and 500 milligrams per meter squared, and you'll see variation in the intervals between 2 and 3 months. I suppose we're just being a bit parsimonious here, but since there's no evidence in favor of one or the other, we use the three-monthly schedule and the 375 milligrams per meter squared dosing.
You also mentioned rituximab alone as an option. In what kinds of clinical situation do you use that strategy up front? And again, what kind of schedule and duration?
So this now brings us into an area where there seems to still be some considerable controversy or disagreement about the usefulness, efficacy, and safety. So returning then first to symptomatic patients. So symptomatic patients with low tumor burden and they're treatment naive with advanced stage follicular lymphoma have a high response rate to rituximab. And although it's not the specific use to which single agent rituximab has been studied, it's not a great extrapolation to say that one would expect it to work pretty well. And I think it has been adopted by quite a number of clinicians. For the symptomatic patient of any sort, it isn't our choice. returning to the reasoning I was making earlier, and that is if you're going to treat somebody, then why not give them the best chance at the highest response rate and the greatest durability? And I'm happier than to recommend multi-agent chemotherapy.
One of the strategies that's being studied right now in a large phase 3 trial is the so-called R-squared regimen, lenalidomide and rituximab. First, I'm curious if you're participating in it, and would this lady have been a possible candidate for that study, and what you think about the strategy in general?
Well, to answer the latter part of your question, we're in the final stages of locally approving joining that study, and it is being offered to us through our national group, the NCIC Clinical Trials Group, and I think we're doing it in cooperation with an even larger group internationally. So we're basically joining the study, and we'll be looking at the lenalidomide-rituximab combination. The reason to do the study is because of the excitement that surrounds the idea that one could use as simple a combination as lenalidomide and rituximab, and at least the preliminary data lead you to hope that it might perform as well as anything else we would have to offer, including bendamustine rituximab. So we're excited to participate in the trial, and we want to see what the results are. But the preliminary information that justified doing the trial points to a very high level of efficacy and good tolerance for that combination. So the field of managing follicular lymphoma is suddenly accelerating and moving on, and I think we should look forward to a day, not into the too distant future, where we don't talk at all about CHOP and CVP and recipes like that, and we may well have moved on even beyond something like bendamustine or rituximab.
So along those same lines of new agents in B-cell neoplasia, maybe this would be a good time to get your thoughts on some of the ones that we've been hearing about recently, starting out with ibrutinib and adalimumab.
Well, as I was saying, the field has sort of hit one of these sudden acceleration points where I think what we're seeing there is the fruit of the kind of more intensive basic research into these diseases that has been going on now for over a decade. So both of those agents focus on a pathway within the B cell that has to do with the B cell receptor. So B cells post on their surface an antibody that is unique to that cell and matches the antibody they would be capable of secreting into the environment if they matured into plasma cells. So that B cell antibody on the surface, or B cell receptor, if triggered, sets off events within a pathway that includes several different steps, one attached to an enzyme called Bruton's tyrosine kinase, and another P3I kinase, I'm maybe not saying the name quite right, but the point is that it's a multi-step pathway leading eventually to events within the cell that could either protect the cell against apoptosis or trigger it. And so both of those agents, designed because of the apparent key elements of having that pathway activated, are attempting to block or interfere with it. And both of them are turning out, when tested in patients with substantially extensive previous treatment, to have surprisingly high levels of activity and good tolerance. And an additional attractiveness is that they're oral agents, and so we don't have to be giving people injections. So I think what we're doing is moving on into a world where we use increasingly better targeted agents that are specific for the malignant cell we're going after and that can be tolerated very well by the normal cells that are also exposed to the agent. And we'll have to be figuring out how to bring these agents into primary therapy. Now, both of them are a little bit further back in the development pipeline, and they're both appropriately included now in the concluding phase 2 trials and the pivotal phase 3 trials that will help to define their particular usefulness and role.
Any sense about whether these agents in the long run are going to end up being combined with chemo, replace chemo, or maybe used for maintenance after chemo, say, R?
Well, I think that that's what we're embarking on, is figuring out how to make these combinations. And so we'll still be paying attention to the old principle of trying to avoid overlapping toxicity, so that we've got agents that are tolerated at full effective dose because they can be combined without getting combined toxicity on the same organ system from both of the agents. I think it's a little hard to predict how this will fall out because you can start to think of all the permutations. We've got very effective classical chemotherapeutic agent like bendamustine and these newer agents that at least can be characterized as different chemotherapeutic agents, or some people like to call them not chemotherapy at all, but immune modulators. They're chemicals we're putting into people. They're chemotherapy as far as I'm concerned. How we're going to pick the winning combination and then determine if it's necessary to use them in combination, if that's superior to using fewer agents and getting to the same point. That's the work of the clinical trialists, and we're going to see that sorted out over the next 5+ years.
I am curious about your take about the data that was presented at ASCO in Chicago from the trial looking at obinutuzumab, I think it was called GA101 at one point, a new anti-CD20 antibody. And in this study was compared to rituximab, in this case with chlorambucil, versus obinutuzumab with chlorambucil, and then a final arm with chlorambucil alone. At ASCO, they presented data from the three trials, but only the comparison of the obinutuzumab with or without R. They didn't compare the R to obinutuzumab yet, but yet there was data there, and it looked pretty interesting and actually surprising. I was curious what you thought about it.
Well, it was a little complicated to figure out what you could compare and not compare. So the structure of the trial was to have a standard arm of chlorambucil and then two separate experimental arms. One was chlorambucil plus obinutuzumab, and the other was chlorambucil plus rituximab. And so the comparisons that were looked at and examined for statistical validity were the two comparisons, the obinutuzumab plus chlorambucil versus chlorambucil, and then separately, the rituximab plus chlorambucil versus chlorambucil. And what they purposely avoided was comparing the two experimental arms, or at least didn't put statistical tests to any potential difference there. So we're left to imagine the comparison. I am a little wary of that because, of course, there are differences in the distribution of prognostic factors and other aspects of the patients on each of these arms that you want to be careful not to lead to having you draw incorrect conclusions. And it'll be more maturity that we need before we can actually make those comparisons. That said, what emerged was that on a backbone of chlorambucil, you can improve outcome with either of the two interventions, that is, rituximab or obinutuzumab. They're both anti-CD20 molecules. They interact with a different epitope on the CD20 molecule itself. And there are theoretical reasons and some preclinical reasons to think that there may be superiority to the obinutuzumab. But there's enough similarity between the two agents, obinutuzumab and rituximab, that I'm going to want to see some hard data and firm evidence before I'm willing to believe that it is a genuinely more effective agent. So for the moment, I think that they're intriguing. And then, of course, the other problem here is that I think most clinicians now would think of chlorambucil as an appropriate agent in CLL only for selected patients who are ineligible for potentially more potent agents like bendamustine or even some of our more classical chemotherapeutic agents. So the population that one enrolls on a study like that and can only draw conclusions about because that's the population is a special subset of the patients with CLL, not the typical ordinary patient who could have tolerated other chemotherapy that we might have thought was more desirable.
You know, just sort of sitting at the back of the hall looking at those slides, though, it did look, with all the caveats about the statistics or selection, it did look like the obinutuzumab had better outcomes. Is that the way it looked to you?
It looked potentially better outcomes. Let's reserve judgment until we have evidence that we can feel validate the conclusion we might want to draw. And I don't think we're going to see obinutuzumab on the market and commercially available until it actually demonstrates at least efficacy, if not superiority, over another anti-CD20 molecule.
Yeah, that's for sure. Although, you know, it kind of has always been seen to be the case that rituximab didn't work on CLL quite as effectively as it does on the lymphomas. Is that your take?
Yeah, that's always been blamed on the lower membrane density of the CD20 and, of course, the differences in the biology between a CLL cell and a follicular lymphoma cell. So there's the potential that we could design a better anti-CD20 agent. And the company developing it certainly did their homework. They tried hard to aim at a different target, to affect the target molecule in a different way. And they had good preclinical evidence to say that it might work better than rituximab. But this wouldn't be the first time we had a somewhat me too or look-alike drug come along that, when finally tested thoroughly, didn't prove to be superior. So let's be a little cautious here and get the evidence in hand before we start leaping to it.
Yeah, I think it definitely makes a lot of sense and kind of like interesting to think about how we might be treating CLL a couple of years from now, not just about obinutuzumab, but adalimumab and ibrutinib. You can imagine it won't be very long where maybe this disease is going to be looking a lot different, hopefully.
Well, I think the same thing's going to happen to CLL that we saw happen to myeloma a few years ago, where we really hadn't made a lot of progress forward other than to introduce high-dose melphalan for so many years. And now there's a plethora of drugs and clearly established drugs that, like bortezomib and lenalidomide, that everybody's using, and now a whole follow-on generation of improvements on those drugs or alternative agents. Same thing's going to happen to CLL. It makes it, I think, an area of excitement.
It really is, and myeloma is so much different to talk about today than it was a few years ago. Let's talk about your 26-year-old man.
So this is our fellow with a typical presentation of low bulk stage 2A classical Hodgkin lymphoma. So the age, you noticed, is quite a bit younger than the other patient. So typically Hodgkin lymphoma presents with a median age of about 30. So we're into the different population of younger people with usually much less in the way of comorbidity when they come in with their Hodgkin lymphoma. It's their only organ that's ill. And supradiaphragmatic presentation is the most common rule. So when you see a 26-year-old come in with relatively firm, palpable, supradiaphragmatic lymphadenopathy, Hodgkin lymphoma jumps to the top of the differential list. So there was no surprise, in particular, when the biopsy demonstrated that to be present. And about 30 to 40% of these patients don't appear to have extensive disease when you do the full staging process. So he was evaluated first with a biopsy to verify the diagnosis and then the scanning to look for lymphadenopathy or organ involvement. And all we could find was disease in the supraclavicular fossa and in the mediastinum. And he had some left axillary disease. So superdiaphragmatic, largest mass was 6 centimeters. So that's still within the bounds of what most would consider low bulk disease, not the 10 centimeter or greater than 7.5 centimeter that some people like to define as bulky disease. No disease below the diaphragm. And so we then next turned to his laboratory studies, and they were perfectly normal. He might have had a bit of reactive thrombocytosis, a little bit of an elevated platelet count, but otherwise normal CBC, normal chemistry tests. And that's helpful because if you've got an asymptomatic patient with normal blood counts or even elevated blood counts, they're not going to have marrow involvement, so you don't even need the test. And so I was happy that he was adequately staged once I had the imaging studies done. Currently, we're using the combination of PET CT scanning to stage these patients, and so that was done. And you typically do find somewhat greater lymph node involvement when you add the PET scan. It's a more sensitive test. In his case, it didn't extend our understanding of the disease below his diaphragm, so it didn't upstage him. And so at the end of his evaluation, he's got limited stage Hodgkin lymphoma. You don't have to back up too long or go to too many jurisdictions to still find patients like this being treated with wide field radiotherapy or a combination of more narrower involved field radiotherapy and chemotherapy. And the controversy or the area in which we're accumulating evidence that we might move beyond that is in whether there's a necessity for radiation therapy at all. So I would suspect that among your listeners, the most common approach to a patient like this would be a brief course of chemotherapy, most clinicians choosing ABVD as the standard 4-drug regimen, doxorubicin, bleomycin, vinblastine, and dacarbazine. and giving it for a small number of cycles, somewhere between 2 and 4, and then planning to complement that with planned radiation therapy to an involved field or even an involved nodal field to keep it as small as possible, because of our concern that the wider fields and higher doses we used in the past were connected to an excess in both cardiovascular disease and in second malignancies. So nowadays, the standard would be a couple of cycles or a few more than that and radiotherapy. But I do think that we've accumulated enough evidence now to say we can move past that and start to say that a substantial fraction of the patients don't need the radiotherapy at all. The chemotherapy is adequate to the task, given for 2 to 4 cycles, probably if it's being used alone, towards the 4 cycles end of that, and that many times you can spare the patient the exposure to the radiation therapy. So how do you decide that? Well, we have a good, long-term, maturely followed, randomized trial that looked at the strategy of chemotherapy alone versus chemotherapy followed by radiotherapy, the so-called HD6 trial from the National Cancer Institute of Canada Clinical Trials Group, done in combination with ECOG. It was published by Meyer in the New England Journal about a year and a half ago, or maybe more. But that study showed that if by CT scan you had a very good response after 2 cycles, that completing treatment without radiotherapy but just a bit more chemotherapy was adequate, and that strategy produced as good an overall survival at the 10 to 12 year mark as the strategy that included the radiation therapy. That study was conceived of and executed before PET scanning came along. And the difference today is that we have functional imaging to help us sort out what's going on with Hodgkin lymphoma when there's a mass, but you don't know if it's actual malignant lymphadenopathy or if it's simply residual fibronecrotic material. And functional imaging seems to be very good at making that distinction in Hodgkin lymphoma. So we've built or extrapolated from the randomized trial I was describing to integrating functional imaging into our usual management of limited stage Hodgkin lymphoma. We do a PET CT scan after a couple of cycles of ABVD, and if it's negative at that point, which it is in 80% of patients, then we don't plan any radiotherapy but conclude treatment with 2 more cycles of ABVD. We think that's a sensible way to build on the earlier trial and the usefulness of functional imaging. And I think the concept has been validated by a large trial called the RAPID study done in England with a little bit different structure. They took similar patients, limited stage disease, treated them with 3 cycles of ABVD, and then did a PET scan. When it was negative, they had the courage to stop treatment at that point in time. But if it was positive, they gave another cycle of chemotherapy and added radiation therapy. They found that approximately 75 to 80% versus 20% split I was just mentioning, with most of the patients having a negative PET scan after the planned 3 cycles of chemotherapy. So it nicely agrees with what we've seen here in British Columbia when we use it after 2 cycles. And the outcome for these patients has been excellent, with as good a progression-free survival and overall survival for the entire group of patients as has been seen in any other trial of limited-stage Hodgkin lymphoma. So it validated the idea of using PET scan guidance and that doing so would allow you to avoid radiation therapy in about 80% of patients and still achieve excellent results in the long run. So I think that that's the strategy that ought to be offered to a patient like I'm describing there, and in fact, that's what we did. He was one of the fortunate people who was PET negative after 2 cycles and concluded his treatment with 2 more cycles. We've looked at our results, and when we've taken that approach, the longest time to relapse after treatment has been on the order of about 2 years, and 80% of a couple of hundred patients we've followed have been followed for longer than that, and the curve of progression-free survival is absolutely flat. We're not seeing any late relapses. So certainly seems to be working in our hands to use PET guidance to make that choice.
In terms of new agents, I was curious for your take on the antibody drug conjugate brentuximab vedotin, and specifically where it is and where it's heading in Hodgkin lymphoma.
Well, somewhat similar to the idea of all the excitement in myeloma and CLL, brentuximab, vedotin, has brought some of that same kind of excitement to the Hodgkin lymphoma field. It's an interesting agent. It's an antibody-drug conjugate, so the antibody portion is aimed at CD30, which is universally expressed in classical Hodgkin lymphoma. And linked to that is a monomethyl auristatin E microtubular disruptor. So it's a magic bullet type of medication. You put that into the patient, and the monomethyl auristatin E is inactive while still linked to the antibody, binds to the surface of the malignant cell, it's internalized, dissolved, and frees up the monomethyl auristatin E, leading to microtubular disruption. The striking thing was that when the pivotal study was done and looked at this agent in patients that had had not only primary therapy, but a relapse and high-dose chemotherapy and a stem cell transplant, that 75% of the patients responded well to this agent, and 33-34% of them had complete responses, which actually is a remarkably good performance for a single agent. And gratifyingly, it was accompanied by very manageable and modest toxicity. The leakage of the monomethyl auristatin E from the dying cells does carry with it the potential for some neurotoxicity. And typically what you see is neurotoxicity that would remind you of the same that we see in the vinca alkaloids, comes on gradually and reverses with either omission or reduction of the dosing of the agent. So it's quite manageable. And now we have a single agent with a remarkable level of activity. It's already licensed in a number of jurisdictions, and they're expanding numbers every day. So it's become available as a single agent for this relapsed patient after they've had a stem cell transplant. So it's in clinical use. But the real excitement, of course, is trying to move it earlier in the treatment. Two places you can think of, that would be first probably as the part of the lead-in chemotherapy prior to a transplant, for the patients that are going to require that for first relapse. But then even more exciting will be to integrate it into primary therapy. And I was part of a study in which we looked at our ability to add brentuximab to standard ABVD. We learned a painful lesson that you can't safely combine it with bleomycin, which was a bit of a surprise because when given as a single agent, patients had already had bleomycin universally, and there was no excess pulmonary toxicity. But when you give the two agents at the same time, you see a very dangerous level of pulmonary toxicity. And clearly, the two agents just should never be combined. But it leaves the potential to combine the brentuximab with the doxorubicin, vinblastine, and dacarbazine, which are probably the workhorses of the ABVD anyways. And now we have at least the potential to throw in an agent that's considerably more effective on a single agent basis than bleomycin, avoid the bleomycin toxicity, and potentially boost the effectiveness of the primary chemotherapy. Now that's a hypothesis. That needs to be tested in a prospective randomized trial, which fortunately is being done right now. And so we will get the answer, does AVD brentuximab work better than AVD bleomycin? And we ought to wait until we get the results of that trial to move it into the early position, but many of us are hopeful that's what will be accomplished.
Could you comment a little bit more about your own experience with the drug in terms of the neurotoxicity that you described? When do you typically see it? And can you reinitiate the drug if you stop it?
It's a cumulative toxicity. And so when we were doing the phase 2 trial in which it was given as a single agent, it came on gradually after multiple cycles had been administered. It was typical in distribution and type, so it was often a tingling dysesthesia, a distant peripheral neuropathy affecting hands and feet and then arms and legs. In the trial, I think that there was a tendency for the patients on that trial to minimize the toxicity, at least what they reported to the physician, because it was making their Hodgkin lymphoma so much better, they didn't want to run any danger of the drug being stopped. But if you carefully question the patient and watch for this, it does tend to come on. And remember, these patients have already seen neurotoxic agents in the past. They've already had vinblastine and perhaps cisplatin or other neurotoxic agents. But it does emerge, And we've used kind of the same rules we've always followed for the vinca alkaloids. So a minimum amount of the toxicity, grade 1, possibly some early grade 2, we often ask the patients to put up with it because it isn't interfering with day-to-day life. Beyond that, it is interfering with day-to-day life, and you should entertain the possibility of dealing with it. I think there's probably two strategies one could attempt. That is to reduce the dose and carry on with it, or omit the dose and bring it back in again if the neurotoxicity diminishes. I don't know which of those two would actually work better. My tendency has been to stop the drug if there is activity-limiting toxicity and to bring it back in again. But I think we're going to be revisiting this and see. What's good is when you stop the drug, the neurotoxicity reverses in the majority of patients, but it can take a while to go away. And you can bring it back in at a lower dose, and you don't seem to see exaggerated neurotoxicity. But clinicians should be careful of this, because remember that patient who's minimizing what they report to you and getting more ill but not telling you about it, they can show up then with pretty significant neurotoxicity. You want to be sensitive to it.
Brentuximab vedotin has also been used with great success in anaplastic large cell lymphoma, and you've been involved with that research. Any comments on that and where that's heading?
Well, there it was surprisingly even more active, or apparently more active. So the phase 2 trial that looked at patients with relapsed anaplastic large cell lymphoma had a higher overall response rate and a, if I recall correctly, a 58 or 50+% complete response rate. In a disease that on relapse we've often found difficult to manage, the relapses tend to occur in the patients with the ALK-negative variety of anaplastic large cell lymphoma, and that disease is difficult to bring under control even with quite aggressive management. So I think brentuximab certainly has the chance here to transform the management of that disease. With that excellent level of activity, the approvals for the drug have been in that situation, that is, relapsed refractory anaplastic large cell lymphoma, to be used as a single agent. And all the data I've seen emerge since then is consistent with that same high level of activity. But of course, the real excitement would be around figuring out how to bring it into primary therapy. And there, the strategy that's being pursued is to bring it in as a substitute for the vincristine. So we're going to bring in one neurotoxic agent in place of a different one, this time hoping that its contribution will be a much higher level of efficacy. So it's a chip versus chop type of comparison, and we're going to get to see from that trial whether it changes our ability to control the disease with the backbone of chop without the vincristine.
So let's finish out talking about your 60-year-old man.
So this is our fellow with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So as is exemplified by his history, which was only a couple of weeks, this is a fellow who went from well to symptomatically ill with a painful tonsillar and upper neck mass, painful to the point of interfering with swallowing, already leading to weight loss, and so much more abrupt course than either the other two patients. Consistent with the biological behavior of the disease. Remember, this is a disease that proves lethal in median of 6 months if intervention is not effective. So this is a disease that can present as advanced disease, but maybe a third of the patients will present as localized disease. So you have to go through the exercise of quickly assessing the distribution. He presented with a tonsillar mass and a neck mass, and on evaluation, we couldn't find disease elsewhere. So he fell in also into this category of limited stage disease. Had the same investigations, the imaging tests, including PET scanning and bone marrow biopsy. Didn't seem to have any accompanying organ dysfunction, so liver and kidney function was good. It's going to be able to tolerate our standard agents well. And we now, clinicians, specialists around the world, have been using a recipe called CHOP that we've discussed already as the backbone of treatment. And of course, a number of clinical investigations have attempted to improve on that. And it has proven to be quite challenging to do so until rituximab came along. And that very clearly augmented the effectiveness of CHOP without adding any daunting toxicity. And probably added at least 15 to 20 percentage points onto both the progression-free survival and overall survival expectations for these patients, and is now the standard. Moving past that has proven more challenging. Intensifying the recipe by giving the dosing more frequently, every 2 weeks rather than every 3 weeks, looked promising in the earlier studies but didn't pan out in the randomized trials. Adding additional agents has proven difficult because the ones chosen, like etoposide, often bring along the overlapping toxicity and you're getting into myelotoxicity problems. So we're looking for a way forward. But at the same time, a story somewhat similar to the one I was describing with Hodgkin lymphoma has unfolded, and that is the ability to focus on whether combined modality therapy is necessary or whether many of these patients might not be treated with unimodality chemotherapy as an approach. We have at least one good randomized trial looking at CHOP versus CHOP plus radiotherapy, showing no difference in outcome, and therefore reasonably expecting that when we moved to CHOP-R, both of the groups would have moved up in effectiveness, and so we'd still not see any contribution from the radiation. So we've taken an approach very similar to the one I described for Hodgkin lymphoma, where we're giving initial chemotherapy, 3 cycles, and then looking to see what was achieved. If the PET scan says the disease is gone, and it can be gone even when there's a residual mass, if the PET scan says the person's in a complete response, we've been concluding treatment with 1 more cycle to bring them to 4 cycles of treatment. That's still an ongoing, essentially phase 2 experience, but gratifyingly effective. The patients are doing just as well as they did before when we radiated everybody, and only about 1/3 of the patients require radiotherapy. So I think you would find in most places that brief chemotherapy, with or without some radiotherapy, is the usual approach for patients like this, and you can have a high expectation of a good result.
In terms of, you know, moving the field forward in terms of the treatment of this disease in general, I'm curious what your thoughts are. We talked before about R-squared, and we're now starting to see some data on so-called R-squared CHOP, so adding lenalidomide into R-CHOP. I think that's now going into a phase 3 setting. What are your thoughts about that strategy?
Well, I think it's based on adequate preliminary information to say that we can be hopeful that it will make a difference. But it's another example of us making sure that we don't let hope get out ahead of evidence. And we need to see a couple of things there. We need to see that you can add effective dosing of lenalidomide to CHOP-R as a backbone and not run into any unexpected toxicity. The early data suggests that you can do that, but I want to see a greater body of data. And then we have to see whether, in fact, it proves to augment the effectiveness. It's sobering to remember just how many times we've tried to improve on CHOP and then later CHOP-R. And we better be a little humble about this and admit that it's a tough enemy we're dealing with here, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And we want to see the validated evidence that a change in treatment actually is achieving a better outcome. So I'm hopeful those studies will move along quickly and that we'll see not only lenalidomide, but some of the other agents we mentioned. Ibrutinib is a fascinating drug to think about using here, and how we might integrate that into the primary regimen. And there are several different trials going on at phase 2 and phase 3 level looking at attempts to add agents to the CHOP-R backbone.